Welcome to The Awesome with Cody. I am Cody. We're wrapping up January, which means we're in the month of the awesome of Guillermo del Toro movies, I guess you should say, because he didn't go into his TV shows at all. I think I talked a little bit about him, but didn't really go into the actual TV shows. But today we're going to do two movies because I wanted to do both these, and I ran out of weeks. That's why I combined a couple movies. I combined Hellboy 1 and 2. But today we're going to be talking about Crimson Peak and The Shape of Water. These two, they're not like sequels of each other, like anything other than the fact that they're both in their own way gothic horror romance movies. And I'll get to that later about those. First, we're going to talk about Crimson Peak. If you haven't seen Crimson Peak, Crimson Peak is Guillermo del Toro's answer to The Haunted Hotel after he was wasn't able to actually do the Haunted Hotel movie he wanted to do because he wanted to do a rated R Haunted Hotel movie for Disney. And Disney was like, no. So Guillermo then made this movie, and this movie is not to say it's anything like the Haunted Hotel, but it's about ghosts and things like that. But just like every Guillermo del Toro movies, blah blah blah. There's lots of layers involved in it. There's a lot of storytelling and foreshadowing and imagery and suggestive things. This one is definitely not escaping any of those things. Again, I'm gonna spoil some stuff. So if you haven't seen this, A, shame on you. B, you're ready to get spoiled. This particular movie stars Mia Wasikowska's, I guess. I don't understand the name. I'm terrible with names in general. But Mia, some of you may know as Alice from the newer Alice in Wonderland movies. The Tim Burton one. I don't know if I'm explaining that properly. But there was Alice in Wonderland. I'm trying to see where it's at here. Bah, bah, bah. Alice in Wonderland in 2010. Oh, she played Alice. I don't know why I had explained that to you. And then reprised the role of Alice in Alice through the Looking Glass. Not going to talk about those movies, but she's in those. She's been in other stuff too, but those will be the two biggest ones you may know her from, especially since she looks exactly the same in both those two movies, and this movie is very similar. Cut to her hair and the way she dresses because of the gowns and all the stuff she wears. So in this, Mia plays Edith Cushing, who is the daughter of a wealthy businessman named Carter Cushing, who's played by Jim Beaver. Some of you may know the name, probably not. It does sound funny. But his most recognizable role for you HBO people would be Deadwood. Television-wise, he's done a lot of different things. Most recently, well, Deadwood is probably his biggest claim to fame, I would say. He was in the majority of that show. He's been in tons of other television shows for one or two episodes. I mean, every Law and Order, every show you can imagine. He's got a very recognizable face. But Deadwood is by far his most popular one. He was in all three seasons, if I'm not mistaken. I could probably look it up. He played Whitney Ellsworth in that. So, yes, for if you Deadwood fans out there. Which, by the way, if you haven't seen Deadwood, it's a terrific show, but I'm pretty sure they tried to convince us that the Old West is where they invented cussing, because they use terribly bad language in that show, but not that it offends me at all, but, you know, whatever. He plays a businessman who is approached by Tom Hiddleston's character, who is Sir Thomas Sharp, who is a baronet from England. Him and his sister come over to try to procure money for an invention of his. He's trying to build to mine clay from their property back in England. And the clay is very good for bricks and all sorts of other fun stuff. But he's trying to bring up capital because they don't have enough money because their family's falling on hard times. You'll learn why later. And so he comes to America looking for backers. He is brought over by one family. And then he meets Edith for the first time and becomes enamored with her. You can kind of see it right away. And then the love triangle, because there always is a love triangle somewhere in there. You have Charlie Hunnam's character, Dr. Alan McMichael, who is a childhood friend and their male child from the family that brought over the Sharps originally, because Thomas was supposedly coming over to court Alan's older or other or his sister, and it turns out basically he falls in love with Edith and kind of goes from there. Edith is a very headstrong, free thinking woman. She wants to be a writer like Mary Shelley, as it's said in the movie. Obviously nobody believes that she can be a writer because, well, woman writer, back in the day, in 1887, New York, they weren't women weren't really seen as, go-getters and things like that. They were more secretaries and homemakers and things like that. The story kicks off, Thomas Hiddleston's character, Thomas, obviously shows feelings for this. Edith's father, Carter, notices this because the way they look at each other, and he wants to shut it down because he believes that Edith needs to be with Alan because Alan has a thing for her. They've known each other for a long time, those different things, love triangle. So after the first meeting with Carter and all of his financiers with Thomas, they turn him down, and just something about Thomas and his sister, well, Thomas mostly, because he hasn't really met his sister yet, kind of rubs Carter the wrong way, besides the fact that he's got, googly eyes for his daughter, and his daughter's got googly eyes for him. He takes it upon himself to hire a private investigator, who is played by a returning cast member from Pacific Rim, Bernd Gorman, as Mr. Holly, who is specialized in finding dirt and history on people. This happens. There's this dance that they go to, where the intensity of the relationship between Edith and Thomas really kindle, because he shows up to her house when she wasn't going to be going to the ball or to the dance ball, whatever you want to call it. He talks her into going. He waited there until her father left, because he knew he would turn him away. They start up a relationship during this. I should say the opening sequence is the end of the movie. Very well done, because you start with this drab white scene where Edith has a large contusion on her forehead, and there's blood, and she looks very shaken, and there's this bizarre looking land, and she says the statement, ghosts are real, I know I've seen them, or something like that, somewhere in the realm of that. And then later you get a flashback, so you get her narrating the beginning of it before any of this happened, happens. She gets visited. She basically, her mother dies when she's very young. She was taken. She was killed. She died from the flu. One of the illnesses basically couldn't have an open casket, so she didn't get to say goodbye to her mother. So she has. There's this dream, though that's weird. She thinks she has, but it's really a ghost of her mother who shows up, and it's a very creepy scene. The way they do the ghosts in this movie, and the ghosts, there's two main ghosts that are in it. The two that are in it, so the mother's Edith's mother and Lady Beatrice Sharp, who's the mother of Thomas and Lilith. By the way, I didn't mention this. Lilith is played by Jessica Chastain. Lucille Sharp. That's Thomas's sister. Doug Jones, a returning Guillermo del Toro fan, our favorites, comes back. He plays the ghosts of the mothers. And he is that really, again, we talked about this before, and we'll talk about him again because he's in the next movie too. But his stature is very, very unlike most. He's got very long, slender fingers, and he can articulate his body in very creepy ways by popping joints in different ways to make it look like they're, you know, not human. So he does a really good job of that, especially for the Lady Beatrice Sharp, the ghost of Lady Beatrice Sharp, not Lady Beatrice Sharp. That's played by somebody else. Actually, I don't think you actually even see Lady Beatrice Sharp other than news clippings and a painting. So nobody really plays her. But then the other ghost, the other actor that plays a couple ghost roles, named Javier Bonet, I think it is. B-O-T-E-T, not that you matter. He's been in a lot of different things, but he's one of those guys that doesn't play voice acting. He's just a creature actor. Most notably, he was the crooked man in The Conjuring 2. I haven't seen it yet, but he's the Russian witch in Knock Twice. I heard it's really fun. But he's a motion capture for the Alien and Alien Covenant. He was in The Mummy, the new one. He was the leper in It. So I guess you'd say he also plays in the new Insidious movie, The Last Key. Plays the key face, is very creepy there. But the biggest thing is coming up, which may or may not be a good movie, probably bordering on not gonna be a good movie, is gonna be he's gonna play Slender Man in the Slender Man movie. So that should be fun. Another very good movie, creepy creature guy. So, you know, that's who plays the other. It plays three ghosts in Crimson Peak. We'll get to that a little bit later when we go to the story more, too. So you get the mother sequence where she warns Edith about Crimson Peak. Long story short, that plays into it, is why I brought it up. Plus, Doug Jones plays the ghost, so it's super awesome. Edith then also starts to have feelings for Thomas. It's seen on both sides. Of course, Carter, her father, gets the news back from Mr. Hawley. It's very, very apparently damning enough, because they don't tell you what it is until later, that he's going to basically pay off. He's going to give Thomas a certain amount of money and Lucille to leave. And part of the they're going to leave the next day. And part of that also is Thomas has to break Edith's heart. So she won't be longing for him and things like that. He has to irreparably break her heart. He does. He gets slapped in front of the rest of the party guests at the dinner party they're having when he confronts him. Very, very bad way. He sends a note to Edith explaining this the next day, but what she doesn't know yet is her father has been murdered earlier that morning. And unfortunately, in my eyes at least, you kind of can tell who the killer is. Unfortunately, because of the what the person, you don't see the person's face. You get a look at the silhouette of them from behind. You can see the shock look on Carter's face when he gets a attacked by this person. It's Lucille, Thomas's sister. The way they make you think is it not her? Is it her? Because the way her hair is done up and the way she walks, and then obviously the shocked look on his face, on Carter's face, and it's like, oh, it's a woman. Kind of gives it away. I think I remember thinking that originally when I saw it. Obviously, by the end of the movie, you find out that it is her. But I think they were trying to make you think it was her, so you think it's Thomas, or you think it's somebody else. Anyways, I think I remember always thinking it was definitely her that did it, but whatever. As the movie goes on, so he dies. The fortune obviously goes to his daughter. They get married. And she moves back with them back to England, where they are going to live their lives and go by and live on their lands and do all those things. What you don't get right away is the fact that their living situation is not great. They don't have a lot of money. That's why they're looking for money for inventions. But when you get to the spooky house, it's run down. It's got a hole in the roof and snow or winds coming through, and house is just run amok and it's sinking into the clay. And there's a section of rotted floorboards and Thomas stands on it and clay seeps through the breaks between the boards. And you realize that, oh, they don't have any money and they're barely surviving on this. And so that's why they're trying to capitalize on getting money for this invention, because they think they can turn the business around and save them. So it goes from there. You get it right away that Lucille does not like Edith. And you think, oh, you know, she doesn't think he's good enough for her brother. That's not the reason why. We'll talk about that in a minute. Strange shit starts happening to Edith. She starts hearing things and seeing ghosts or glimpses of ghosts. There's this dog that that runs up to her when she first shows up with Thomas. He convinced Thomas to keep it. Lucille then sees the dog and says, I thought he was gone. And he's like, well, I thought he was too. I mean, he was going to survive in the out there by himself, but whatever. Plays a part later on. So goes on, and she starts seeing more things more drastically. They're telling her to be careful in the house. Don't go below this level of the house. Don't go to certain rooms. There's locked doors. There's a really creepy scene when Edith is playing with the dog. She hears a noise. They go over to this closet. She grabs it. She's opening up, and the dog's doing something. Or she tries to open it, but it's locked. So she goes away, and then the door slowly opens without out of her vision, and this, like, it's open. And then when it cuts back to her, in the opening is this creepy red skull creature. And you hear, like, what sounds like a scream, and the door slams, and of course scares her. And then she opens it back up real quick, and it's just, like, a closet that has, like, an echophone in it, which, by the way, an echophone is a wax cylinder. Phonograph. It's a wax tube instead of a wax platter like records were later on, and it allows you to play music and other audio. So that leads in the story. We'll gloss over a bunch of that because you can watch for yourself how creepy the ghosts are. A lot of visuals in it. If you have a chance to watch special features, there's a bunch of interviews. They talk about the different shooting sets and stuff like that. And one of them happens to be this hallway, or this corridor, as Guillermo calls it. It's this very long corridor that uses pretty cool visuals, but also these, he points out, because it always seems like the corridor when they're shooting it is out of focus in a way, but like in focus. And what he actually tells you in the interview is that they triple up the the design of everything. So like the, when it has arches, there's three of them, and it makes it look like there's more to it than there is. It's a very creepy hallway, and a lot of the ghosty stuff happens in that, which is pretty cool. So Edith goes on. She can't handle this house anymore, so Thomas decides to bring her with him into town to pick up these last parts they need for his machine. They end up getting snowed in and having to stay there, and they finally do the deed. They go from there. When they get back, Lucille's very cold to him and her. You can see that she's like not doing well. Edith's not doing well, and of course Lucille's like, yes. There's a bunch of stuff that happens. The turning point is where she starts to cough up blood, realizing something's wrong. The ghosts start to be more frequent. The house, she starts exploring more of the house, trying to find the secrets. She finds his trunk. All sorts of shit happens. Ends up, you find out that Thomas and Lucille had a very traumatic childhood. They were mentally and physically abused by their parents. Their dad beat their mother so bad at one point she broke her leg, and Lilith had to take care of her. Or Lucille had to take care of her. Why call her Lilith? Jesus. Lucille had to take care of her. Then you find out that there was a brutal murder in the house, and the only people home were the children, and Thomas was too young, and so the blame went to Lucille. She got put away in a mental institution because the murder was of the mother, and a meat cleaver was slammed into her head so hard it almost split her head in half. So you turn out, you find out, like, you know, she killed her mother. And later on, obviously, the other thing you find out too is Thomas is previously married, and they disappeared as well. She ended up murdering them and keeping their bodies in the clay pits underneath the house. So they show up as red ghosts. That's pretty cool. What a way of doing it. Very visual colors, because the Black Death that took Edith's mom, when she comes back, she's a black ghost. Her bones are black, and she's wearing black, and she's the wispiness of the black. It's pretty dope. And of course, the ghost from the house that they're in are red because of the clay, because the bodies are left in the clay pits below. It's pretty cool. You finally find out why they call it Crimson Peak, because when it snows, the clay seeps through the snow, turning it blood red, and looks like, so they call it Crimson Peak because it's on a peak of a mountain and it's red. Crimson Peak. Which spurs the warning that Edith's mother gave her when she was younger, when she appeared to her, that beware of Crimson Peak, but she didn't know it was that before that happened, so she gets freaked out, and she's just looking into the deaths, and she finds out, but Alan comes in, because he actually hired Mr. Holly the same way Carter did, and finds out the same stuff, goes to save her, all sorts of shit happens, there's a fight, Alan gets stabbed, and then they go against, and then you find out that Thomas really fell in love with Edith, so he goes to try to stop Lucille, and then Lucille ends up killing him in a brutal way. She stabs him in the face, right into his left eye, and it goes in. It's brutal. He's pulling the knife out. It's fucked up. Then, of course, she goes after Edith, blaming her for his death, even though, I mean, really it was her that killed him, but whatever. You know, crazy people. Because you find out that Lilith and Thomas are actually lovers from early in life, and they've been tricking these people into giving them money and things and so forth. So that's the big secret. So I remember, not just his sister. And of course, there's a big fight, and then Lucille chases Edith. Edith goes, sees Alan where Alan was left because he was fakely killed by Thomas. And then they're supposed to escape together, but Lucille's on their... I really want to say Lilith. Lucille's on their tail, so they're going to fight, and they got upstairs, up through the because they're down in the clay pits. They go up this machine, and they have this thing in the what they call the basically it's upstairs where all the snow's at, and it's on a set. They call it you know what they called it in the interviews. But they have a fight. Lucille's about to kill Edith. Edith just has a shovel, and of course she has this giant butcher knife that she used to kill her mom. A very creepy scene where she unveils the knife. And she says, you hear Edith says, help me. And she's like, there's no one here to help you. And she says, are you sure? Turn around. And when Lucille turns around, you see the ghost of Thomas, all white, because his body wasn't left in the clay, so it didn't turn red. And he distracts Lucille. When Lucille turns around, she gets hit in the face with the shovel. And then she says to Edith, I won't stop until you're dead or I'm dead. And she goes, you don't have to repeat yourself. Or she hits her one more time, snapping her neck and like probably caving her head in, and says, I heard you the first time. Or you don't have to repeat yourself, or whatever it was. And then, of course, that's the end of it. And that's the, she goes and touches Thomas's face, her hand then ends up going through, and you see the wispiness on her fingers, realizing that he did love her at the end. And then you get to the scene where the movie opened, where she's standing there all in white, very pale, has a cut on her forehead. And she says, this is the point where I learned ghosts are real, or whatever it happens to be. Very terrifying movie. The ghost, the creepiest part. The only one issue I have with it is the death of Carter. Cause you can tell it's Lucille, just by the design of her outfit and everything like that. But in the look on his face, if they didn't show that, then it would have been a little better to me, at least. I don't know. Anyways, that's it for Crimson Peak. We'll go to Shape of Water real quick. Shape of Water, the newest film by Guillermo del Toro, another gothic love story, if you will. The reason it's gothic is it's very dark. The tone of the movie is very dark. It happens mostly at night. But there's everyone seems very villainous and very evil, and that's the thing about gothic horror movies, or gothic movies in general, is that there's very little light in the world, especially in characters. And in this movie, Shape of Water, tremendous movie, by the way, very hard R, not what I expected going into it. Won a bunch of awards so far this year, and it's up for like 13 nominations for Academy Awards, which is insane. Definitely deserved it. It's a gorgeous movie. Amazing movie. Well acted by everybody. This movie is set in 1962 in Baltimore. I'll go over very quickly because we are kind of running over, but sorry, it'd be an extra long episode for you guys. The cast is very small. Sally Hawkins plays Elisa Esposito, who's mute. You have Michael Shannon plays Colonel Richard Strickland, who is the bad guy of the movie. You have Richard Jenkins, who is phenomenal in this movie. We talked about it on the main podcast. You have the returning Doug Jones playing the amphibian man who doesn't actually have a name. You have Octavia Spencer, who just won or is nominated for, I think she won something. I can tell you right now. I think they won a bunch. I know they're up for a bunch of Academy Awards, but the Golden Globes, they won a couple different things. Best Director and Best Original Screenplay at the Golden Globes. They obviously Academy Awards, they're up for, like I said, 13, which includes Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, as well as other things in there. I think costume design, something else too. I can't remember. I think audio, it might be editing, maybe mixing. Is it mixing or sound editing? I can't remember. We talked about it on the main podcast. But this movie, right away, dispels it moves itself away from a lot of other movies that are very similar to it in their creature ways. The creature is very dangerous in this movie, but the people that are surrounding him are more dangerous. The movie itself was created by, or the idea for the movie was created by Del Toro, and a writing partner of his, Daniel Krauss, who later co-wrote the Trollhunters novel, which was then turned into an animated TV show for Netflix, which is amazing as well. It's very, very Creature from the Black Lagoon, Merman, very Abe Sapien, the way he designed the character. A lot of people think it's a secret origin story of Abe Sapien, and it could be, but, you know, this is set in 1962, so who knows, timeline-wise. Doug Jones does an amazing job as the amphibian man. Doesn't really talk. There's a lot of sign language because he learns to speak sign language from Sally because the friendship they develop together, and she's mute. So she uses sign language. Michael Shannon's villain in this is really one of two in a way. There's the Russians who have a mole inside this organization that they work for, who's played by Michael Stahlberg, something like that. I can't remember. I don't know how to pronounce that. He plays the secret Russian agent who's after this asset, as they call it. And then both sides want to basically figure out how this creature survives underwater and how long it's been there. They pull it from the rivers in Ecuador, I believe it was, South America. I know for that for sure. Where he's basically seen as a river god by the natives, and this organization who works for the government as well as the Russians want to figure out how he can breathe without air, in the efforts to basically exploit that for use to go into space in the space race. So that's a fun little throw in there too, because it's in that feverish time where it is a space race who can get to space first, the U.S. or the Russians. So that plays a big part in it. But really, the ultimate story is the love story that blossoms between Elisa and the amphibian man. When the movie starts, like I said, it separates itself from a lot of other movies. It's even some of Guillermo's movies. It's a very densely it's populated by very dense characters who have a lot going with them. When you meet her for the first time, she puts a bunch of eggs on to boil. She sets an egg timer, goes to the bathroom. You think she's going to take a bath. She does, but then she starts vigorously masturbating into it. It was a very bizarre way of starting a movie. And it's in the bath, and it's very, very, you don't like watch her right on. You do it. You base the cameras focused on the egg timer sitting on the sink, but just out of focus, just to the left, is her vigorously masturbating in the bath. It's a very weird way of doing it, but it is a very interesting thing. Then it goes from there, and it's just like I said, everybody, the much like all the gothic movies, gothic romance, gothic horror, what do you want to call them? All the characters are very dark, evil in a way, and this doesn't go away. It's normally like in Crimson Peak, the source of light and good was Edith. In this one, you'd think, oh, it's got to be Elsa, right? Like it's gonna be or Lisa. It's gonna be Lisa who's the bright, and it's not. It's actually none of them, but probably the most angelic or light person would either be Zelda, her best friend played by Octavia Spencer, her best friend is her neighbor. And even then, it's kind of hard to say they're best friends. But it's either going to be Richard Jenkins Giles, who is Lisa's next door neighbor, or Zelda, her coworker/friend. Both of them have their very big flaws. Zelda is a homemaker as well as a full-time employee. She cares for her husband, and she's always complaining about Elisa because, well, who's not going to complain about being talked to as a mute that can't talk back? But then you have Giles, or Giles, who's her next-door neighbor, who's an eccentric artist. Later on, you find is a homosexual, and there's a whole thing about him trying to find his way, and the fact that he was fired because of stuff, but you don't know what it was, from his job, where he was an advertisement, he designed ads. So there's that, which is pretty crazy. There's a confrontation later in the movie with him and this guy, this waiter at this restaurant they go to. That's very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable, because it starts off racist and then it goes into homophobic. It's crazy the way this movie goes. But the gothic part is, just like in Crimson Peak, everybody has this dark element to them except for one person. That's why in this one makes it a little different, because everybody has this darkness to them, including Elisa, who is one of the darkest characters in the entire movie. So then you come about and you find out it's none of that, and it's the Amphibian Man who has the most light in him, because all he wants to do is be who he is. He's not trying to do anything, and he falls in love with Ilsa, and they have this kindred spirit of both of them being misunderstood and thought of differently than they actually are, and then it goes crazy directions. They end up having sex, which is nuts, because then later on, you, like, Zelda asks her, like, how is that possible? And she does this thing where it's like a clam and then opens up. It's fucking nuts. And then later on, they show what the merman's crotch looks like before, without a penis showing. And you get the gist of, like, oh shit, that's what she's talking about. It's fucking nuts. Amazingly done the way they do. It's very humorous, very real. So much to it. And then of course the end of the movie, you find out that Ilsa's special. She has these scars on her neck, which everyone attributes to her being mute, but you find out she's actually just like the Amphibian Man, and he has the ability to heal people, and he heals her, and he reverses the scars, and you find out they're gills, and she goes to live under the sea with him, escaping the bad people. Spoiler alert. But when this movie comes out, if you haven't seen it in theaters already, if you don't, it's not playing in the theater near you, it's a very limited release. And it comes out on iTunes and digital and disc and stuff. I highly recommend you watch it if you like Guillermo's movies, but also just movies in general, because the movie itself is so well made, amazingly shot, amazingly set up, like the sets they're on and the environments they're in, and again, we talked about this on the main podcast, but the way they do it is so amazing, because you feel like it is back in 1962, but it's this capsulized, iconic look of everything, with the movie theater that they live above, with the marquees and the way the restaurants are and the way the people react to each other. And it's just a tremendous, tremendous movie. Very real, very, very much different than I thought it was going to be. But tremendous movie as well. It's pretty awesome. But I think that's going to be it for this week's episode and this month's theme of Guillermo del Toro's movies. But that's them. That was Crimson Peak and a little bit of The Shape of Water. And I'll probably talk about more when it comes to another topic too, because I like talking about this movie a lot. I'm going to try to keep this one a little bit shorter. I'm running up on the 40-minute mark here. But that's it for this week's episode. Come back next week when we start a brand new month and a brand new topic. I believe next month's topic, if I've done my math correctly, and I think I have because I'm the only person who has to check my math, is I will be doing romantic comedies for the month of February, because it is the month of love, because of Valentine's Day and all that fun stuff. I'm not trying to get too mushy, but I'll go into a bunch of the... I'm going to do more of the I'm going to try to do more current ones in the last few years. We'll go over that too. So this is going to be another reason to watch them again. So that's it for this week's and this month's topic. And as usual, that's the end of The Awesome with Cody. I am Cody, and let's stay awesome.